We're gonna launch right into it, and we're gonna ask William to kind of give us some overview and kind of the history of ecological devastation on the planet, and kind of give us kind of some perspective on how we need to be thinking about this issue.
Yeah, thanks, Kenneth, for that, and thank you everyone for joining us tonight. You know, ecological devastation, for those of us who have our students of history, we know that that's fourth prong is not one of the original three ills that Dr. King referred to in the original Poor People's Campaign. But it is one that we wanted to bring up in the new Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, as an attempt to acknowledge that the U.S. political and economic system is not just based on systemic racism, poverty, and a militarized war economy, but it also is based on the allowance of corporations to profit from the exploitation and destruction of Earth's vital life support systems. So that's the context that we really wanted to uplift as we kind of engage in this next iteration of the Poor People's Campaign, to kind of put things in perspective on how serious this concept of ecological devastation is. Worldwide, pollution caused an estimated 9 million premature deaths, 16% of all the deaths, which happened in 2015. According to the Lancet Commission, this was three times more deaths than from AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined, and 15 more times more deaths than from all wars and other forms of violence. You know, water pollution alone is responsible for 1.8 million deaths worldwide every year. And while poor countries are the worst affected, pollution-related illnesses are most prevalent and most impactful among the poorest and most marginalized people in all countries. You know, our economy as it is and our political system, it even commoditizes the necessity of water and makes it unaffordable, inaccessible, and unsafe for millions across the globe. And this is really towards the benefit of privatization, profiteers, and for polluters. You know, it also exposes millions to the risks of water scarcity in some regions, while exposing, as a result of climate change, others to flooding in other regions, you know, for the benefit of the fossil fuel industry. And when you look at the southern portion of the United States especially, you know, there's a deep intentional engagement there. You know, when you look at the top 10 states in the continental US who have the highest share of household income consumed by electricity costs, they're all in the South. You know, when we talk about energy burden, it's all in the South. When you talk about the largest number of billion-dollar weather and climate disasters, they happen in southern states. You talk about that four of the top five biggest carbon polluters in the power sector in this country are in the South. And millions of people in the rural South are also monopolized by electric cooperatives, in which they are then disenfranchised members who do not know that they have ownership stake and a right to vote. And this issue of ecological devastation as it manifests in these southern communities compound the very familiar issues of systemic racism and persistent poverty, which we are familiar with as residents, you know, of the South. And you can even look at the case study of the Warren County, North Carolina, you know, which is a special place near and dear to this conversation, but also near and dear to our hearts with all of us hailing from North Carolina. You know, Warren County actually was the birthplace of the environmental justice movement. It was a community which was primarily of color and was targeted for the dumping and the siting of a toxic landfill in 1978. To start the story, in the 70s, researchers found evidence that PCBs, chemicals called PCBs, were both toxic and carcinogenic. This research led to a ban on the production of these chemicals and the passage of the 1976 Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, commonly known as RCRA. RCRA led to many new changes, including special stipulations about how PCBs were disposed of. Fast forward to 1978, Ward Transformer Company, located in Raleigh, hired a local North Carolina trucking company to dispose of PCB-laden transformer fluid. Under the new requirements, the new federal RCRA requirements, the toxic fluid was supposed to be transported to a special facility. This company, took it upon themselves and decided to circumvent that extra expense by illegally dumping this fluid. For nearly a month, the company snuck into Warren County, North Carolina, under the cover of night and dumped around 31,000 gallons of toxic fluid. This contaminated approximately 60 tons of earth along 240 miles of highway right in Warren County, in the heart of this community of color. Robert Burns, who was the owner and operator of the trucking company, and Robert Ward of Ward Transformer were eventually jailed for these actions, but the soil was contaminated. You know, and because of the recent record legislation, North Carolina was actually compelled to act. In response, the state decided the best process for remediation would be to site a landfill in the very area that had already been neglected and devastated, you know, by this illegal dumping. At the time, Warren County was 65% Black. It ranked 97 out of 100 for GDP, and 40% of the homes lacked indoor plumbing, so they were especially dependent upon their groundwater. What this meant was, at the time, Warren County had the highest percentage of Black residents in the state and nearly the lowest per capita income. And the belief, the common belief, was that these demographics were the real reason behind why that county had been selected for placement of the landfill. Residents were immediately horrified, right? And they were rightly concerned because they saw that the dump site would pollute the water and deter new investment in the already vulnerable economy. But they also saw the siting of a toxic landfill as a gateway of continued targeting of environmental pollution in their home, in their backyard, really. Residents immediately formed action groups. They began attending EPA public meetings, and they tried to express that concern. That if this landfill was sited in this community, it would solidify and incentivize this area to be continuously targeted for dumping in the future. And, you know, that would just add injury to individuals who are already modest income, individuals who were already, like we said, you know, 40% of them depended on groundwater, not having access to indoor plumbing, and would just, you know, be really devastated by this. Adding insult to injury, it was soon discovered that while the landfill was outwardly advertised as having optimal conditions to prevent contamination of the groundwater, that state officials at the time were actually working with the EPA to loosen requirements around proximity to groundwater to make the construction of this landfill easier and to happen more rapidly. The state executive had also loosened state laws concerning public hearings, which traditionally were required before major civil projects like this were undertaken. Furthermore, an independently hired researcher found that the soil in Warren County was not ideal because it could not compact sufficiently. As such, it was highly likely to leak and contaminate the shallow groundwater, you know, confirming the concerns of the residents. For the next 2 years, there were a number of lawsuits from landowners, the town of Afton, as well as the NAACP. But despite these efforts, the landfill was approved and construction begun in 1982. The real story, though, is that once that happened, as the first trucks entered Warren County, they were immediately met with resistance from the local residents. More than 500 people from the local community engaged in acts of sustained civil disobedience over the next few weeks during the construction of the landfill. Despite these efforts, you know, the landfill was not derailed, but the concerns of the residents were found to be true later on. Warren County became the home of 40,000 cubic yards of contaminated soil. PCBs and dioxins were found in the groundwater up and downhill from the landfill at elevated levels, and the landfill wasn't closed until 2003. So, you know, although residents were not successful in preventing the landfill from being constructed, they were successful in shaking the national conscience and building out this vein, which we're continuing upon today, which is one acknowledging, you know, the urgency of an understanding of ecological devastation and understanding, more importantly, how that issue compounds and impacts already impacted in at-risk communities. You know, Warren County was the first time citizens mobilized in advance to protest the landfill, and their action, their courage, helped to establish the model of protest against continuing environmental threats. The scenario also led to a 1983 report that found that 3 out of 4 hazardous waste sites, so 75% in 1983 in the southeastern portion of the United States, were located in primarily Black communities. So when you talk about the connection between systemic racism and ecological devastation and militarism and the war economy and poverty and inequality, you know, you see that these communities, which have already been impacted along one of these prongs, are often continuously targeted or continuously damaged as these realities play out and manifest along the other three. So it's important as we engage with this PPC that we have a holistic analysis and really kind of uplift and understand that ecological devastation has to be a part of our engagement, especially in this current day and age.
Thank you, William. I guess we're going to be playing with the mute button this whole time. I do want to encourage the viewers to post questions and engage in this town hall, you know, so we can get a feedback loop going. We'll read all of your questions and answer the ones that we can. I'll ask a question, a quick follow-up for William is, even though we see the disparity in those who are affected by ecological devastation most immediately, what do you say to the people who feel like environmental issues are really, they're issues for the privileged who have the time to fight about them?
My initial response is I absolutely empathize with why that sometimes is the view. You know, it's hard to often think about environmental issues with which oftentimes are issues which the consequences of are years and decades out when you're dealing with the very present reality of poverty, you know, when you can't feed your family or when you're dealing with the very present reality of systemic racism. You know, those are things that people can often see presently. So it's hard to shift mindset and then say, I'm dealing with this, but now I also have to be worried about, you know, the potential impact of climate change, you know, 10, 20, 30 years out. So that's a hard ask to ask of people. You know, I think it's necessary though for those of us who claim to be advocates of these communities to have a lens that not only focuses on those immediate realities, but acknowledges that if we don't uplift this ecological analysis, those communities which are often already torn apart, you know, by systemic racism, already torn apart by bad public policy that undercuts their economies, already torn apart, you know, by lack of economic opportunity, will then be just even more devastated because of the consequences, you know, of climate change and ecological devastation. You know, not only because these are often situated geographically where major damaging weather disasters happen, but because when those disasters do come to pass, those communities often don't have the economic stability to move away or to seek, you know, refuge somewhere else. So you trap people both in their reality, but then you add the extra weight, you know, of damaging the environment in a way that is going to, you know, detrimentally impact their lives. So I think I get it. And I understand, full stop. But also, you know, as advocates, we have to make sure to uplift that lens and incorporate it in our analysis.
Thanks. Okay. And so if anyone else has a response to William, speak now. Okay, so we're gonna move to Sunny. And Sunny, do you wanna go ahead and give us some context and insight on how landfills are targeting minority communities and the impacts of coal ash?
Yes, thanks, Kenneth. I'm gonna be basically reiterating some of the things that Will said earlier. And also talking about something that happened in my town where I grew up and still live, where environmental racism is, and that treating Black communities as if they're disposable through their land and environment is something that's just as present today. And I, this is also in North Carolina. So first I wanted to give like a brief summary. I also wanted to add something to what, while Will was talking about why we, about how it's hard to have that like future vision when we're thinking about now, when we're thinking about the realities of what's happening right now, in terms of struggles we face like day to day instead of more future oriented in the years to come. I think about the fact that governments and white communities won't accept this won't accept this kind of treatment and force it onto communities of color and poor communities is really, it shows that they have thought ahead, that this is something that they know is toxic because they don't want it in white communities and they don't want it in rich communities. So there is an intentionality behind environmental racism that is huge. And so I just wanted to name that as I go into these statistics. These things didn't just happen because people are being pushed to the wayside. They happened because we live in a country that is based off of white supremacy and classism. So I gathered a lot of this information from a article called Environmental Justice, Race, Poverty, and Environmental Health. And it's published by Tufts University, if anyone wants me to send the link out. It talks about how hazardous waste sites, municipal landfills, incinerators, and other hazardous facilities are disproportionately located in poor communities and communities of color. This, just around the time that Will was talking about in the 1970s and 80s, they first started doing studies on how toxic waste and on the relationship between toxic waste placement and race, and realized that they were disproportionately put into communities of color, specifically historically Black communities. So for example, they did a study in 1987 that found that there were 27 hazardous waste landfills nationwide. And the three biggest ones were all located in Black zip codes. So where there were primarily Black people living, that is where the hazardous waste landfills were. And so that was in 1987, but then another study was done recently, basically proving very similar results, where in Massachusetts, for example, a study of the distribution of hazardous sites and polluting facilities found that communities of color and working class communities are significantly more are home to significantly more hazardous sites and facilities than wealthier communities. So that's what we can always go back to, that this is something that people are planning and understanding, that like they're not, white people and white communities and the governments that represent them are often understand that that's not something that is something that they would want in their communities, in the places that they actually are representing. So it does give an insight as to how this is very much rooted in white supremacy. So specifically, I wanted to talk about a landfill that was built in 1972 in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, in a historically Black neighborhood, that is still Black and has been where the community has been fighting for over 40 years to get the toxicity of the landfill to be removed and for them to get reparations from the town. And it has just been an utter crisis of scapegoating where no town, no government official wants to take responsibility for the damage that they have done to this community. So this landfill was built in 1972 with the knowledge that it wouldn't have had the capacity to hold all of the waste that Chapel Hill produced. But very similarly to the story that Will described in Chapel Hill, people started protesting right away. They did not want their homes to be contaminated. They understood what the implications were, but then the town tried to manipulate them and bought them out creating a new recreational center in their community as a way to tell them that they were going to build a recreational center only after 10 years of having the landfill. So they negotiated that, but then of course fell back on their negotiations. And so people around the community had been protesting the impacts of this landfill, which made their water unusable and their sewage systems basically broken for the last 40 years. And it wasn't until February of 2018 where reparations really happened. And I'm not sure if we could even call it reparations now. They are just finally getting sewage systems that work. And in 2010, studies were conducted that found that people used well water because they didn't have access to the water that most people in Chapel Hill had. And they found that all of the wells had were below EPA's water standards because of the toxic waste that was burdened onto them into their water. So the fact that this was a 40-year-long struggle that didn't end until February of 2018 is indicative of something really big, you know, and this is happening around us all. So I just wanted to add that a few of the leaders of this community are very close to my heart and my family, and I just wanted to lift that up. Coal ash, I also am meant to talk about, but I know less about it because it's not in my backyard. However, I am learning that it is something that everyone should be concerned about. If you don't know what coal ash is, it is the waste produced when coal is burned for electricity. So it's captured by several different things. By something called scrubbers, and it's captured as bottom ash, which settles into the bottom of furnaces. So every year, U.S. power companies generate and have to dispose of millions of tons of coal ash. And in 2014, for example, that resulted in nearly 130 million tons by itself. And then in North Carolina, as many of us know, in February of 2014, Duke Energy, which has a monopoly over North Carolina's energy systems, they had a coal ash spill in one of our rivers, the Dan River. And 70% of the impoundments that collect and clean up the coal ash that was put into the coal ash, into the Dan River, are located in low-income communities. So again, this is just a very targeted attack, even though it might not seem like it, on low-income communities and communities of color, and That is all I have to say right now, but I hope that wasn't too much information thrown at everyone at once, but thank you for listening.
Can I add one addendum to your summary of the coal ash issue?
Yes.
Just one point I wanted to mention is that Duke Energy right now is planning to collect $230 million in coal ash costs from its customers through a rate hike. And that is one of the many ways in which the public is forced to pay for the negative externalities of a private company's actions. Yeah, that's all.
So that's really interesting. I think it kind of raises the question of what, and anyone can jump in with this, what would ecological accountability look like? Like, what would it need to look like?
I think I'll
go for it, man.
I'd just hop in. I think ecological accountability means taking responsibility for all of what your actions entail. It's recognizing that in whatever you do, whatever you use comes from somewhere, and whatever you discard goes somewhere. And so recognizing that means whether, if it is waste, how do you dispose of it? And at some point you're going to have some waste, and you just have to limit that, reuse as best you can, recycle as best you can. And when it comes to supply chains on the front side, how can you ensure, try to support local farmers, local communities, and try to ensure that you do supply things as best as you can?
Right. To give a concrete example to what Ethan just said, which I completely agree with, North Carolina has 33 coal ash impoundments where they store the fly ash and the bottom ash that Sunny mentioned that come from these coal-fired power plants. They're stored in these kind of unlined lagoons, and all of them are leaking. So, you know, we could take steps to line those lagoons, for example, but at some point we also need to understand that this form of energy is toxic, and we need to move towards a swift transition towards clean energy.
I also want to add, and this is more from, I think that I know less about the environmental accountability, but I think in terms of accountability to communities, there's also like in this case of Rogers Road and Chapel Hill that I just talked about, there needs to be like serious acknowledgement and ownership of the devastation that has been that has been perpetrated onto these communities. It's not something that each of us as individuals can take on. It's something, though, we should each be responsible for our own like waste habits and recycling and reusing, but also we need to be, just like these communities have shown us, we need to be holding corporations and governments accountable for what they are allowing to be perpetrated against these communities that are most impacted.
If all conscious are clear, we're gonna move forward. To Zainab. So Zainab, can you talk to us a little bit about water contamination, specifically with Gen X? I told y'all we were gonna be playing with this mute button all day. We can't hear you.
What? Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now.
Great, okay. Oh my God, but I'm joining to my, okay, anyway. It's gonna be loud. I'm at a coffee shop and it's not quiet for some reason. But anyways, I'm actually, what's cool about this is that I'm hoping that you guys can kind of hear me, right? Right, okay, I'm just gonna go with it. Okay, so I'm gonna talk a little bit about Gen X, just kind of like the basics, and then kind of just maybe talk a little bit more about my personal work in water. So Gen X, if you guys are familiar with it or not familiar with it, it's short version, it's basically a very dangerous but poorly understood chemical. And it's been in one of North Carolina's primary rivers for years. No one really knows how bad it is and well, people now know how bad it is. And the state legislature actually started investigating the presence of this compound, which is known as Gen X, in the Cape Fear River last June. Or this June. Which one was it? Can someone correct me there real quick? I don't know. It started investigating it. Okay, perfect. Thank you. Just want to make sure. They started investigating it this June, and it is basically the company that produced Gen X was ordered to stop dumping it into the Cape Fear River, and that it made the water contaminated. It made it, had a lot of toxic chemicals in it, and Gen X is basically a chemical used in the manufacturing of Teflon, which is like the stuff that's used in like nonstick pans and like laptops and cell phones. And so that lovely stuff was not lovely. It was in the water that people were drinking who had their water sources, the Cape Fear River. And so basically it was an unregulated chemical, so it had been allowed to be discharged into bodies of water in North Carolina since it was developed kind of recently. The Department of Environmental Quality said definitely that Gen X was produced by DuPont, which is a manufacturing facility just south of Fayetteville on the Cape Fear River. And it's still there. It, to this day, still employs about 900 people. As early as 1980, actually, the company produced Gen X as a byproduct of its work. And in 2019, they started intentionally making Gen X to sell. And researchers at NC State first reported elevated levels of Gen X in the Cape Fear River in 2016. And the state started investigation and also detected the compound in the water. And so they basically were ordered to stop dumping the chemical and others like it into the water. But I mean, the damage was done. It's very harmful. The problem is we don't even know the impact of the harm. There's like the federal government has all sorts of rules about chemicals we know are toxic, but there's not really any guidelines around Gen X. DuPont says Gen X is safer than chemicals that use, and that, the state's claims are unsupported by any facts or science, which is very untrue since, both NC State and the state investigators found out that it was toxic. And actually testing by both the city of Wilmington and Brunswick County are also now showing levels of Gen X below what the state of North Carolina considers likely to be safe. So there's a huge contamination of water in a broad, vast aspect in North Carolina. Basically, what's really being done about it through organizing and whatnot is that, there is one, I think the state of the North Carolina House is considering, nothing's been done yet, considering a bill that would redirect about $1.3 million to the Department of Environmental Quality to test bodies of water and soil. That could be, I guess, their first step, but we kind of already, know things are going on. So it would be nice to get some more like regulation or, to really hold these companies accountable because, not only are they, disposing of waste freely, they're also harming the residents that they're coming, they're taking advantage of communities yet, or they're taking benefits from communities and also harming them in the same place. And I feel like governments need to hold these corporations or companies to really higher standards. And they shouldn't be obviously not allowed to do this, but they should be fined, or people should have access to clean drinking water. That's not something that should ever be taken lightly. They've been sued. Brunswick County actually sued DuPont over the chemical discharges and trying to figure out how to fix and improve their improvement plan. So the city local governments are moving a little faster than the state government is. And so it's just crazy to think that this is, less than like an hour from here, which I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina, and just an hour out, people just don't have access to proper drinking water. And if anyone knows, those areas are highly concentrated with minorities as well. So there's a whole aspect to this, and I'm not gonna, I think for me personally, just water in general is just something that I think even until recently just grew up with realizing how much of a privilege it is that not everyone in this country and not everyone even in my state or even city has access to clean drinking water, and that it's something that we look at overseas and talk about how countries don't provide these types of resources for their citizens, and we are contaminating our water. And once again, specifically for people who don't really have the power or voice to speak up and stand out, which, you know, are mainly poor communities. And they're able to get away with this because they can, and because no one, you know, don't have that. I mean, like as everyone said, just kind of trying, yeah. But I will say, me personally, I just actually coincidentally came from an event with Wake Up Wake County, which one of them, I'm on the board there, and we had one of our major issues that we focus about is water, specifically in Wake County. And so just making sure that our water sources like Falls Lake and Jordan Lake are kept safe. And, you know, for the overall, I think that that's one where we have to recognize my privilege that I do live in a city where that's not as much of a problem, at least where I live. But it's something that I can't imagine that just, you know, a few miles, a few, what, like 30, 40 miles out, somebody doesn't have that same access. So that's, anyone else want to jump here? Totally feel free, but that's kind of where,
yeah, I definitely want to encourage any viewers who may have just joined us to jump in. You can post your questions on the live stream. And again,
I wanted to jump in.
We'll try to answer them.
I wanted to jump in with just one ray of hope related to this whole issue in terms of people power, which is that back when Scott Pruitt was the administrator of the EPA, he had nominated this man, Michael Dorson, who's literally a pollution skeptic. Like, we know climate skeptics are a thing, but he is skeptical that pollution has negative impacts on our health, to be the chemical safety nominee. And due to the whole Gen X issue, people who get their water from the Cape Fear River flooded the phone lines of Senator Tillis and Senator Burr from North Carolina. And they were a major reason that Michael Dorson didn't get nominated. So just wanted to throw out that kind of ray of hope. It's sad that the whole Gen X issue needed to happen in order to get that small victory in the first place. But when the people come together, we really do have the power to make some change.
Thank you. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to shift to our guest panelist, Lamisha. Lamisha with KFO. Tell me if I'm saying your name right or wrong. You got to take it off mute.
Give me a second. Okay, can you hear me now?
We can hear you.
Okay, we're good. Yeah, it's Lamisha. So thanks for asking. Yeah, Lamisha, or as some call me, L-A, either one. So thank y'all for having me on today. So once again, I'm Lamisha Whittington Kaminsky. I am the, just a brief introduction of who I am. I'm the North Carolina Democracy Campaigner for Friends of the Earth, but I have definitely had the privilege and honor of working alongside Poor People's Campaign since early this year, about February, with Friends of the Earth. So thank you all for having me on today just to speak briefly about CAFOs, exactly what they are, exactly the harm and devastation that they do bring in general, but specifically to North Carolina and our citizens here, and exactly why it relates to Poor People's Campaign and the fight, right? So not only am I a democracy campaigner, I'm a native to North Carolina, and I do have agriculture background and root from my family. My family was one of the first families to be graduates, so my ancestors, of the Rosenwald Schools that Booker T. Washington founded. So we were raised and bred in the fire of agriculture, sustainable ag, and being farmers for trade. So being rural and being North Carolinian is near and dear to who I am. And so this is extremely important, just to preface. So to jump right into what CAFOs actually are, we hear these a lot, but CAFOs by dictionary definition is concentrated animal feeding operation, an industrial sized livestock operation. So to make that a little bit more tangible, all they are storage units. They're storage units that animals are contained inside or caged inside on large corporate farms, right? And so that's the term you hear all the time with CAFO. Other popular terms you hear are mega farm, animal factory, hog motels, poop factories, and the most, and I would say popular, is industrial farms. Okay, so here's the thing. So when we say animals that are housed within the storage units, we're usually talking about chickens, dairy cows, and hogs. And a CAFO can house anywhere from hundreds to millions of animals. So this isn't a small, you know, kind of thing we're talking about, this is really large. And if you hear stuff in the background, excuse me, I am in a public meeting space. So to move forward, a CAFO can confine animals for at least 45 days or more per year in an area without vegetation. CAFOs can include open feedlots as well as massive windowless buildings. So no sunshine, no vegetation where livestock are confined in boxes or stalls. Okay, so that's just a really kind of like tangible definition of CAFOs. There are two types generally of CAFOs. It's the houses, livestock, and buildings, what I just told you about, and these animals seldom leave, and removing their waste is a major challenge. The second type is a feedlot, and I mentioned that briefly at the top, in which keeps the animals outdoors in pens, and manure waste accumulates on the ground and oftentimes washes off into ditches and streams. So their waste can wash into fresh water source, and does. Okay, so then that's how we get into it. What's the big deal about this? There we go. So the big deal is the amount of urine and feces produced by even the smallest CAFO is equivalent to the urine and feces produced by 16,000 humans. 16,000. And that's the smallest CAFO. The waste generally isn't treated. There is no method of how chemicals are actually treated. The chemicals that are used during the process of production, such as pharmaceuticals, heavy metals, and pollutants. So all this is contained within the waste, and there's no chemicals to dilute that or to help that. There are over 168 gases that are emitted from CAFOs, from CAFO waste to be specific, including ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, and methane. All we already know is hazardous. And animals frequently die in CAFOs. So their carcasses are generally often in large numbers. When we're thinking about thousands to millions of hogs, that's a lot of numbers, right? And they must be disposed of. But how? We then have infestation of flies, rats, and other vermin that are commonplace in CAFOs, but not just there. They're also commonplace in neighbors' residents, in their yards, when they live beside these CAFOs. Okay, there have been reports of this, of citizens in North Carolina who have said, I've walked in my fields, I can look right across, see the production, see the CAFOs, and then I see rats that are like the size of napkin dispensers in restaurants. So this is real. There generally isn't a proper sanitation for waste and other contaminants, like I already stated. There's clean water used to wash animal waste, and that water is then stored in a waste storage structure. We've seen this in North Carolina. They're called lagoons. They're literally ponds all the way up to a size of a lake. So they can be the size of several football fields. So a small lake. These lagoons contain waste. I would say hog fetuses or livestock fetuses that didn't go full term, deceased carcasses. All this is within that lagoon and it's purified to be a liquid. There is no regulation as to how long you can let that sit. So generally lagoons can fill up to 6 months. Before they come in, empty the lagoon. And then how do they empty it? It has been reported that it is emptied by spraying all of this, that includes those chemicals, this waste, the fetuses, all of that over farm fields. This is in North Carolina, y'all. These farm fields are sprayed. Now, the argument has been said, hey, we use this like fertilizer to help the nutrients of the soil. But the reality is, there can be a such thing as too much, and there is. If you overwhelm the soil with too much fertilizer, if you overwhelm it with too much, the land actually cannot absorb the nutrients from the actual waste in and of itself, in addition to the chemicals that are in it as well. So that argument is kind of debunked, it's mute, it doesn't really apply because it's too much. Where have we seen an example of CAFOs? We've seen it here in North Carolina. We've seen it across the states, such as in Sand Branch, Texas, where they have not had clean water in 30 years. By the way, I mean running water. They have to have bottle donation. And more specifically, to come back home, we've seen it in North Carolina. Some of the damage, just kind of to go into why this is important with Poor People's Campaign, why we're fighting, and why it is important that we stand with citizens across North Carolina, especially in the eastern part of North Carolina, is because history repeats itself. 1999, Hurricane Floyd came through and it spilled 50 lagoons, which many were located in floodplain, flooded, and six ruptured. 50 lagoons. 2007, it happened again. Hurricane Matthew caused 16 giant lagoons of hog waste to overflow and two to breach. And as a result, there was fecal matter in water sources in North Carolina that contain parasites, bacteria such as E. coli, salmonella, and equally harmful carcass fluids. This was in fresh water sources in North Carolina. Yes, there was cleanup afterwards, but really, I ask you, you can look this up. Please Google it. Please fact check. The water was red. Someone described it as looking like the Nile River in the Good Book, where there was contaminants and waste. This was in North Carolina. Flash forward to now, early 2000s up to present. We've seen the same thing with Smithfield Corporation, which is not American owned. It's not American ran. It is actually a corporation outside of the United States completely that operates the corporation here in the United States, specifically North Carolina. To get more to why this is important is because North Carolina went from 15th to 2nd in hog production between the 1980s and the 1990s, which means it grew. It was an explosive growth that resulted in thousands of CAFOs in eastern North Carolina. If you've heard about research, if you've heard about this term, you know that eastern North Carolina is considered in research the Black Belt. It means exactly what it says. It is a crescent-shaped band, and it's an area in eastern North Carolina that emancipated slaves, and now their descendants lived within this area and worked as sharecroppers after slavery. This part of eastern North Carolina is known for high rates of poverty still, poor health care, low educational attainment, unemployment, and substandard housing, and on top of that, CAFOs.
Can you leave
us? On top of that. Yes, I'm sorry.
Can you leave us with one final word on?
Yes, yes. I definitely get passionate, so they bring back in. This is what we really want to know and to fight. Number one, two things. It is not about local farms. We are protecting local farms by fighting industrial farms. Industrial farms are stopping local farms from growing, from receiving taxpaying funding dollars to grow and to build economic sustainability and mobility. And number two, this is about protecting our poor, our impoverished, and all of our citizens in North Carolina by placing CAFOs stop to it. Stop placing our taxpayer dollars, support what Poor People's Campaign is doing so we can stop these CAFOs and hurt them where it hurts. And that's the money in these industrial farms.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. And for all of you joining us on Facebook, please do post your questions. We'll read them and we'll answer what we can. We're going to move to Ethan. Talk to us about climate change.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for joining us tonight. Good to have all y'all here. And thank you. LA, for joining us and spilling so much great knowledge on CAFOs with us. So I'm here to talk about climate change. As we know, it's a very big subject. It can be kind of daunting to talk about with people in everyday conversation. And so I hope to be able to break it down and kind of break it down into some bite-sized pieces so that people can use this in an approachable manner in everyday conversations, wherever you may be. The key to that is really making it local. It's while climate change is a global thing, unfortunately, we're already seeing its effects at local levels. But before really getting into that, really to understand the effects of climate change, you can really understand almost all of them through one basic effect of principle of physics, which is the idea that hotter air holds more water. It's pretty simple. Just the hotter the air is, it holds more water. And what that ultimately means is that it exacerbates existing trends wherever you may be. If you're in a dry area, it gets drier. If you're in an area that has bad thunderstorms, you have bigger and worse thunderstorms, hurricanes, wildfires, anything like that. As an example, the Washington Post recently had an article that had a quote that kind of shows this for the United States. The average temperature is rising rapidly across the United States. Heat waves are becoming more extreme and will continue to do so. Overall precipitation has decreased in the South and West and increased in the North and East. That trend will continue. The heaviest precipitation events will become more frequent and more extreme. Snowpack will continue to decline and large wildfires will become even more frequent. That is, in a nutshell, what we can anticipate across the United States. An exacerbation of existing trends. But as I've said, you want to connect these things as local as possible. And so to connect these some of these issues to North Carolina and then more broadly to the United States, for a few quick hit issues, wildfires obviously have been a huge issue in California recently, with the Carr wildfire killing 8 people, burning over 100,000 acres, and is expected only to get worse in the coming days. So definitely keep them obviously in our thoughts and prayers and hope that they can take care of that. Wildfires have been an issue in the North Carolina mountains in many recent years. Last year, tens of thousands of acres were burned within one fire in particular. Hundreds were evacuated. Thousands have been involved as far as rescue efforts and fire control efforts in the North Carolina mountains in 2017 alone. So these are issues that are only expected to get worse. Along with that, droughts have been periodic. Right now, 97% of Arizona is in severe drought. Obviously, all of the Southwest continues to be in a drought, with the Colorado River running dry through large portions of it. The Southeast has seen periodic droughts. 2016 was particularly bad, including North Carolina. And between 2006 and 2008, there was a 500-year drought throughout the entire Southeast as well. So that also happens with periodic tendencies. We also see a lot of flooding and mudslides through heavy rainstorms, including just recently in this past May, the North Carolina mountains, over 50 different roads were through mudslides and flooding, and downed trees were knocked out. And you can see that getting even worse in the example of Ellicott City up in Maryland, which some of you may remember this year, as well as 2016, they were estimated in 1-in-1,000-year floods twice in 2 years. So I'm not sure quite how accurate those numbers may be. But Ellicott City has been seeing a lot. So again, a lot of this we see in North Carolina, but it's everywhere. Hurricanes are a huge issue here as and elsewhere. As we saw from Lamicia, or as she mentioned, with both Hurricanes Floyd and Matthew spilling hog waste, we get a lot of flooding out in eastern North Carolina. Hurricanes Francis and Ivan in 2004 also did that. So it's with a high degree of regularity we see this types of flooding, both in the east and in the mountains in the west, courtesy of tropical storms and tropical depressions. And as we build these things back, it's not just the hog waste that's an issue and these contaminants. As we rebuild these communities, the communities of color and modest income communities are the ones who get left behind. And so they're not not only the ones who are most impacted, but they're often the ones who get the least amount of help. To double down on that, the News and Observer to mention how much flooding has been an issue in North Carolina. Over the last 15 years, North Carolina has had a flooding event every 7.5 days. So almost every week, we see some sort of flooding in North Carolina somewhere over the last 15 years. So this is a very regular event. There are many areas that are repeated flooding, and sea level rise is another issue that I just to touch briefly, I know we're running out of time. But sea level rise is another issue that North Carolina is particularly affected, Virginia and Louisiana as well. But we have recently seen up to 1 inch of sea level rise per year on certain areas of the coast. And they actually expect 6.5 inches of sea level rise over the next 15 years in Wilmington. That's due to both subsistence, where the land literally, because of how we built on it, is sinking, as well as the sea literally rising. So that's why you see so much in certain areas, so much sea level rise, where other areas you don't see as much, and why Wilmington is so vulnerable. But I just want to reiterate that when it comes to these issues, focus on local issues is how to approach these. They are global things that it's very easy to get lost in. But when you want to talk to and really make an impact in talking to other people, talk about how you see it in your daily life. And that's where you are. It changes.
Yeah. Thank you, Ethan. I think what we're going to do, we are running a little short on time, but the comment sections will stay there. And so if people do want to follow up and continue to ask questions, we will continue to engage with you. I'm going to go ahead and ask Rebecca to talk to us about some next steps, because we got a lot coming up in the coming weeks.
So actually, I wanted to interject, and I think Anita had a piece to wrap us up with that I think we need to hear. And then if Rebecca can close us out, that'll be great.
Okay, sure. Well, let me just follow Ethan's advice. I wanted to talk about energy and dirty energy, but in order to make it local, I was going to talk about pipelines, and specifically in the context of North Carolina, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. And I just wanted to talk about why it's an environmental justice issue, the way it affects communities, what's happening now, and what we can learn from it as a case study. So just what the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is, it's this 600-mile fracked gas pipeline that's supposed to go through Ohio and Pennsylvania and West Virginia to way through ending in Robeson County, North Carolina, proposed by Duke and Dominion. And there are actually a couple other pipelines that we're facing in North Carolina right now, including the Mountain Valley Pipeline and the Piedmont Pipeline. I'm just going to focus on the ACP. But why it's an environmental justice issue is that it's routed into poor Black, Indigenous, and rural communities. It goes through 8 counties, and 7 of those 8 counties have a substantially higher than average poverty rate for the state, which is sad yet unsurprising. It would affect more Native, Black, and poor people than any other infrastructure project ever proposed in North Carolina. Specifically, it crosses through territory of the Lumbee, Halawasaponi, Waccamaw, Coharie, and Meharon tribes in North Carolina, and it threatens official sacred sites of the Tuscarora and Waccamaw peoples of North Carolina. Although I must say that other, you know, unofficially undocumented sacred sites are also being threatened. Jules on Facebook mentioned that the Dakota Access Pipeline was rerouted through Standing Rock Sioux land from a white town due to NIMBY activism, or not in my backyard activism. And I thought that was a really great point, because that shows just who has political power and why Indigenous rights and anti-poverty work are really tied into what often get billed as environmental issues. So I wanted to call that out. Thank you, Jules. In terms of effects on communities, fracked gas works by releasing really highly pressured water underground to force up shale gas. And the ingredients that go into that water are protected intellectual property of the companies. So we don't even know what's getting pushed underground. And the gas or that mixture can contaminate the water table. And I don't know if any of y'all have seen the videos of people turning on their sinks and lighting their water on fire, but that's an upstream consequence of the fracked gas that's going to come through North Carolina. In terms of downstream effects, compressor stations, which are going to compress the gas to allow a high volume of it to flow through the pipeline, they by design release gas into the air to release pressure every so often, which really increases the risk of explosions. And customers, over 1,000 homes and farms along the route, are forced through eminent domain to allow that pipeline to be buried on their land, which is going to lower their property values, because who wants to live near a place where there's a high risk of explosion? Another further downstream effect is when we burn fracked gas, that releases methane, which is 86 to 100 times more powerful of a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And I won't belabor the point of greenhouse gases, because Ethan already did a great job of talking about climate change. But one point I really want to call out is that the initial estimated cost of constructing this pipeline is $5.1 billion, which would be paid by electricity and natural gas customers, AKA the citizens of North Carolina, because Duke has a monopoly on energy in the state. And that's just another kind of hidden or subtle way that the public pays for this private infrastructure that causes downstream effects like explosions and climate change that the public again is going to have to pay for through all these negative externalities. So what's happening right now, local environmental justice groups have filed a Title VI civil rights complaint with the EPA, saying that the Department of Environmental Quality, in issuing these permits, discriminated on the basis of race and income, which is really promising. And just what we can learn from this is the power that comes through a coalition of all these grassroots organizations. There's this huge coalition, Frack Free NC, my organization, Clean Water for North Carolina, all these others, as well, are really banding together in this fight. And that's really exciting. Two, it was condemned, the construction of the pipeline was condemned by the Student Senate of UNC Pembroke in Robeson County, which is a historically Native institution, which is really exciting because it shows that students and youth are really engaged in these issues because they are the ones who are going to be affected by it, you know, 20 years from now, or in the case of a pipeline, in the next 5 years. Another thing to look forward to is that these organizations, these grassroots orgs, have come up with environmental reasons, health reasons, civil rights reasons, and economic reasons to oppose the pipelines. So we're really doing this work. And then finally, those who are affected by the pipeline, namely landowners along the pipeline route, are the ones who are really at the forefront of this, speaking on this issue. And with that notion in our heads, I kind of wanted to transition into talking about spirituality and the environment, because pipeline fights and environmental fights like this in general often get framed around property rights and whether the government has the right to seize land in the public interest for a private company. But that entire framework misses alternate spiritualities or ways of interacting with the earth that don't see the earth as property at all. And I think we need to interrogate the ways that we consider nature this inert resource to exploit instead of being alive and part of our community and part of our world. And I think that idea ties really nicely into the campaign, which we always say is rooted in our deepest moral and religious convictions. And then I wanted to end, can I end with one proverb? Which is that we don't inherit the earth from our ancestors, we borrow it from our grandchildren. I work at the EPA, and that proverb is kind of emblazoned on the front right when I walk in. Though I should say I was speaking as a private citizen and not as an employee.
Thank you, private citizen. And Rebecca, will you close us out with the next steps?
Yeah, Anita, that was actually a good setup for what I was about to talk about. Let me make sure I get the words right. The economic justice organizing tour that the campaign is organizing 2 weeks from now, on August 12th, we'll have a Sunday morning service at Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina, because as you said, this campaign is deeply rooted in moral values, and you can't talk about justice without talking about also economic justice. And then the next day, Monday, we'll have a Moral Monday in Greensboro, North Carolina, where we'll hear from impacted people from across the state. We will be joined by former Vice President Al Gore and his daughter, who is a strong environmental justice advocate. But we will really be centering the voices of impacted people, those who are most affected across the state. So if you're in North Carolina, just come out and join us. And if you're in another state, just stay tuned. But this is definitely a way to stay engaged within the coming weeks. And I also think I want to leave with a little quote. I saw this quote by James Farmer Jr., the civil rights activist, a few weeks ago. And it says, you know, if we do not save the environment, then whatever we do in civil rights will be of no meaning, because then we will have the equality of extinction. So we're really just fighting to, you know, create a better world, a more sustainable world that we all can live in.
Thank you, Rebecca. So again, join us at the next town hall. And follow on social media so that you'll get notifications of when these town halls and other events with the Poor People's Campaign are happening. If all conscious are clear.
Real quick. I want to shout out our colleagues, Matt Norkey and Thala Swanson, as well as LA, who joined us as a guest panelist tonight, because just as we practice connectivity with these issues, you know, part of our engagement is practicing connectivity with each other and building out this strong coalition to really tackle the challenges of our day and age. So just want to shout them out.
Absolutely. Okay. And I'll just say one more time that, you know, you can share this. You can continue to comment in the comment section. And you can go to the website. Can someone give us that website?
Yeah, if you go to newpoorpeoplescampaign.org.
Then you can sign up.
Yes,
sign up, get email.
Yeah.
And you can get notifications so that you can stay in the loop and you can get engaged. All right. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you to our panelists for really giving us that deep context around ecological devastation. And good night.